Has anyone ever clearly understood the celebrated story at the beginning of the Bible? No one, in fact, has understood it. This priest book par excellence opens, as is fitting, with the great inner difficulty of the priest. The priest faces only one great danger. Therefore, God faces only one great danger: the mortal terror of science. The old God, fully spirit, fully the high priest, fully perfect, is promenading in his garden. He is bored and trying to kill time. Against boredom, even gods struggle in vain. What does he do? He creates man. Man is entertaining, but he notices that man is also bored. God's pity for the only form of distress that invades all paradises knows no bounds. So he forthwith creates other animals. God's first mistake: to man, these other animals are not entertaining. He seeks dominion over them. He did not want to be an animal himself. So God creates woman. In the act, he brings boredom to an end, and also many other things. You see, woman was God's second mistake. How convenient for a priest that woman at bottom is a serpent. How convenient that from woman comes every evil in the world. Well, it's not much of a stretch then to blame her for science. It was through woman that man learned to taste the tree of knowledge. When he took the bite, what happened? The old God was seized by mortal terror. God realized that man himself had been his greatest blunder. In man, he had created a rival to himself. Science makes men godlike. The game is up for gods and priests when man becomes scientific. Moral of the story: science is the forbidden fruit. It alone is forbidden. Science is the first of sins, the germ of all sins, the original sin. This is all there is of morality. Thou shall not know. The rest follows from that. God's mortal terror, however, did not hinder him from being shrewd. How is one to protect oneself against science? For a long while, this was the capital problem. Answer: out of paradise with man. No more happiness, no more leisure, no more free time to think. All thoughts are bad thoughts. Man must not think. And so the priest invents distress, death, the mortal dangers of childbirth, all sorts of misery, old age, decrepitude, above all things, sickness, all devices for making war on science. You see, the troubles of man don't allow him to think. Yet, despite his efforts, man begins to collect knowledge in the fallen world. He builds it as a tower, invading heaven, shadowing the gods. How terrible! What is to be done? So the old God invents war. He separates the people. He makes men destroy one another. The priests have always had need of war. But then the shock comes. War is a great catalyst of science. Knowledge, deliverance from the priests, prospers in spite of war. So the old God comes to his final resolution. Man has become scientific. There is no help for it. He must be drowned. Nietzsche, after writing this, makes a lucid statement. Have I been understood? At the opening of the Bible, there is the whole psychology of the priest. The priest knows of only one great danger. That is science, the sound comprehension of cause and effect. Now, when you read this, you think to yourself, fuck yeah, science, bitch. Open up that computer, flip that laptop open, scroll right into YouTube, smash open that tab, load up 20 videos, one after another, of Christopher Hitchens, of Sam Harris, of Richard Dawkins. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to listen to this stuff all day. No, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to plug it into a boombuster. I'm going to plug it into a big stereo. And I'm going to walk around the park blaring this out to the fucking plebs, waking them all up from their derp mode, from their lack of reason. The reason why this world has fallen is because all these idiots out there are caught up in their hedonism, in their religiosity, in that hangover from Christianity, from religion that we've had from the past, their superstition, and they're all there being idiots. They need to get educated. They need to get informed, and I am the one to do it. I think I might start a terrorist group named Anti-Priest Alliance, and we'll go and we'll bomb churches or something like that, and then we'll fix everything, and over and from the magic of that we'll get science will fix all our biological problems. It will then go on to fix all our emotional problems. It will enunciate on the world the kingdom of heaven. Now, of course, this is extremely sophisticated thinking there. That's not in any way like, you know, derp mode thinking there. That's not what we would call a reactionary position. That's just the stuff. And of course, all of us sophisticated scientific boyos fully agree with Dawkins and Sam Harris. But I, in my heretical ways, want to point out a slight irony wrapped up inside of all of this. You see, these four horsemen of atheism, they have achieved quite a lot. They have worn the t-shirt that said God is dead, and all the people agreed. And it's kind of not really that trendy to be Christian or religious anymore. Jordan Peterson sort of gave a bit of a pushback to that, but he himself couldn't really publicly admit any real faith, and the atheism has sort of swamped over it anyway. It's the main rising religious trend at the moment. This is where everything is going. And I guess today, in my heretical ways, wielding the most dangerous sword of the nastiest German simp who has ever existed, I would like to discuss the power of having a allegorical perspective on modern life. How we have not escaped the archetype. We have not escaped the framework, the architecture, and that is the architecture of religion. Though we don't believe in God, though we don't believe in a church, in some sense, we already live in one. Now, if I was to describe this modern church, using my crude ways, I would describe it as the same as Christianity. I believe that we are Christians, only we are Christianity undressed of everything that makes it sexy. We are the jargon of Christianity without the color, without the body, without the comprehension. And to illustrate this, I'm going to tell you a bit of a story. This is going to be a little bit of a time-traveling story. We're going to be in two separate realities at once. In the first reality, we're going to be peasants in Catholic France. Of course, the peasant wakes up with a cross in the corner of his room. Every morning he wakes up and is reminded, unconsciously, of the religious architecture he lives within. Now you are much the same. See, you wake up, and I know a very small fraction of you boyos might have some type of robotic sex doll in the corner. Please get rid of that. But most of us, nearly all of us, wake up, and in the corner of a room, the shrine, the main focus of our attention, is the phone. And what we do is we wake up and we scroll through social media. Now, this peasant, he had to do a bit more effort in order to get in contact with the social world. He might have to get up, go to church, and see what's going on in the morning. Maybe morning church, we'll say. And these ignorant Christians, you know, he might have walked in and you'd have some guy in French being like, bah-bah, bah-bah. And he'd be probably talking about dogmatic statements about how much he loves God and how much of a good person he is. And he's like, oh, today I caught a filthy boyo trying to copulate with a scarecrow. And I spanked him raw right down the field. This is turning very lewd. I'm sorry, people. I don't know what type of mood I'm in. But so he would stand up there and he would like declare his piety, his righteousness. He would show the people just how great he is. Now, of course, you, saving the fact that you don't need to get up and walk to church to experience this glorious and very, very easy to digest experience of a person acting the moral faggot. You would be able to go on Instagram and look through the big collections of statements of piety in various ways, the various ways that people get up on Instagram and be like, guys, I've reached enlightenment. I've realized that I actually am really good, and I'm going to publicly stand for the cause, you know? You know the way you saw the corporate, and you know the corporate statement from like the PlayStation or something like that? The cause? I'm all for that too, because I'm rebelling against the system, you know? Even though, you know, Netflix and all the international banks, they went for the cause, you know, where they're saying the system's broken. Well, yeah, I agree, the system is broken. I'm the oppressed one, and I stand against the system alongside my church. Well, interesting enough, and you get a lot of this stuff, and it's quite fascinating in the archetypical significance. Of course, it's very good. I think people should stand up for this, and I would never want to get in trouble for saying otherwise. When you are in a church, you must never, never question the heresy, no matter how insane it is. Now, this church, in its benevolent function, is a community organizing tool. And what it might do is announce great projects. Something like a cathedral. Think about those gorgeous French cathedrals. You know, they were built by peasants laboring, coordinated by these people in the church. And we look at these and we think, how grand, how impossible. How would we nowadays get something like that done? These people would build these things over the course of hundreds of years. The church in the town that I grew up in was built during the fucking famine, you know? During the time when everyone was dying, they organized some work to do so that they could pay people, and it ended up building a church. Like, these people build these incredible things. And this cathedral, you know, this is the big French cathedral down the road. This is a great unifying project that's been going on for hundreds of years. And all the peasants are organized around doing it, you know? And we think, well, how would we ever commit that time? We aren't the same, but we are. See, we do our little nibble of the great cathedral of our time. You see, we're building the internet over decades. You think about blockchain and how all these companies are rushing in to try craft blockchain that's creating a sector of the internet. Amazon, Facebook, the original infrastructure that was built there. It's a giant cathedral, and we're dedicating just as much insane amounts of time to it, to the point where the expense on the real world is starting to get drastic, you know. Our attitude towards architecture is dismissive. We turn architecture into just sheets of metal that doesn't matter, because the great emotional project, the great cathedral, is on the web, is in the astral plane, and this is something we're certainly going to talk about a bit more. Think of it this way: the peasant or the French craftsman, he might chip away at the pillars to get the right grooves or something like that, or he might test various subtle colors on the glass windows to get those gorgeous collages you see in Notre Dame. All these very small little jobs, you know, and he might spend his entire lifetime perfecting this, and he might only do maybe just one window or even a quadrant of a window to get it correct. But of course, over the long period of time, these thousands, millions of hours put in by all these people lifts this church into the glorious power that it is. And what do we do? Like, our purpose seems so irrelevant, but we wrestle with the user experience. I've done this myself, you know. So you sit down and you're writing an email, writing an article, and you're testing the background. And this is stuff no one ever notices. This is how subtle this gets. You're testing the background color. So instead of white, you go to this slight bone white that's easier in the eyes. You might dull the actual letters from a black into a soft gray or a heavy gray, so there's just a slight softness to it. And this is the same type of subtlety in creating our wonderful cathedral. Now think of the French peasant cathedral. There were many community things going on: choirs, meetup groups, presentations on the pulpits by the priests. And you would probably meet your future spouse there, some little French hottie in the corner in her lovely little garb, and you would see her family. It'd be probably even more healthy way to meet her and whatnot, and you'd kind of fraternitize or hang out and get together in that type of sense. So it's a brilliant institution. It would provide you with nearly everything you want. You know, the highest of art. If you've ever hear a proper choir going, it's absolutely gorgeous. You would find cool things to do. You could go in and you know, you'd probably find the boyo groups where they talk about the myths and the literature and all that type of stuff. And then you'd have the great public speakers. The way you listen on YouTube to people like myself, you would have the priest standing up there making their announcements. And of course, like in replace of all this stuff, as I said, we have these things on the internet. Spotify is where you see the choir group, or YouTube, the meetup groups, the study groups, Facebook, Discord. That's where you're all going to find this stuff. Now, the universities were sponsored by the church, but that's all moving online now. It's a more efficient way of doing this. The big public speakers, as I said, on YouTube, or even the myths are found on Netflix. It's like our myth machine. And then, of course, if you want to meet a chick, if you want to meet a handsome boyo, you're going to have to go to Tinder. That's where you're going to find it. And look, all these similarities are important to notice. It's important to notice that we don't escape the archetypes, the patterns. We are still in this stuff. It's still there. And our idea that Hitchens has set us free and we're above this is deeply flawed. But of course, it's all a stretch. All a stretch when it comes to the big question. You see, these Catholics are still weird to us because they worship God. And to us, that God is dead. And they're raving nonsense about salvation and happy man in the sky and this Jesus dude who lives forever, who loves you and will protect you. It all falls on deaf ears. This is one thing that we claim has no similarity. It cannot cross. Time has destroyed that. These peasants, they may have done all this stuff the same, except for that one point. But I think differently. So let me describe. See, think for example when the modern after work, the modern peasant, the modern wagee, the modern debt slave, after work he goes to, or she goes to yoga to relax. And you're lying on the cool yoga mat, and it's got all this, it's got the map of the chakras on the yoga mat, and you're there and you're just like relaxing with your yoga, so that's so nice. And then the yoga bunny teacher sitting up the top, and she's playing this Eastern music. Wow, wow, wow. Maybe not like that, but something like that. And she's whispering in a very, very gentle way. She's saying, "You are special." And she might even use these words. She might explain that, well, what God is, this correct definition of God, what God is something that can exist for you. You just have to understand what God is. You see, the universe is all made of consciousness, made of love. It's consciousness and love, and it's found everywhere. It's all over the place. You know, everything is conscious. The animals, the plants, everybody. If you look at other people, consciousness exists in them. And that's what the universe is. It's that loving consciousness, that loving kindness. If you imagine that the universe is made of that, and everything is sort of out there trying to help you, trying to lead you towards love, and what gets in between you and this, the way nature gives you berries and all that, what gets in the way between you and the natural giving nature of the universe is this ego of yours, you know, this arrogance, this pride, this secret Satan inside of you, where you hold yourself off in an intolerant bubble. And actually, all you need to do is you just need to sit down and breathe and say, that consciousness, that love, you breathe into it, feel it, imagine it, feel it, understand it. Think of all the times something good has happened to you and be grateful for it. Feel that gratitude. Be thankful. This will put you in a certain state where you'll walk around with connection with the world, with a natural happiness, a gratitude, a state of grace, where you understand that the universe is there for you and you're connected to it. Visualize how even all these problems, all these pains, all these punishments, they're tests to make you more loving. They're these challenges that are trying to break your ego down so you open up to the world more. So you actually open up to the glorious godlike nature that is already there, the divine nature, the natural divine nature of consciousness and the world and the love. Imagine how everything happens for a reason. You know, think about it. All this whole universe, nature, all the natural consciousness and love that is out there is happening for you. It's trying to lead you back to it. And okay, at this point, she has some nice words and you kind of feel nice and relaxed. You've done the yoga, all the GABA chemicals released inside of you. You're like, yeah, it feels good. And it's kind of cool. It's really cool to do these visualizations, meditate and this stuff. The breathing is nice. And you go home. And despite her nice words, your millennial anxiety comes back at night. There's nothing you can do about it. It comes back. It's here to attack you. The bad chemicals have arrived. And so it was cool, but you don't sink back into it. You say, fuck it. I'm gonna pop the pills. You grab the four different colored pills that you were told to take by your local priest doctor. And you pop them. You take them because, you see, you've tried yoga. You take them because you've tried going to confession with your local therapist, but they'd see it never actually worked. You take them, but you're kind of bitter about it, you know? Who the fuck are these witch doctors? Who the fuck is this priest doctor prescribing you stuff? Who the fuck is this therapist? Who is this yogi? What does she know about your mind? What do these people know about your mind? They're not explaining to you why you're anxious. They're not explaining to you why these bad chemicals are here. Are you just born this way? Is it genetics? Hard deterministic genetics? Are you just broke? Is that how things work? Well, what's going on? Well, like who made them this authority? Are they got their qualification just like a priest that had to go through an academy? Who says the academy is not corrupt? The Catholic Church was corrupt at one point. Like, why do we have to trust these people? What's going on here? In fact, you're actually a little bit mad about this because you've been in the press for a while, subtly, and they're kind of, it feels like they're filling you with bullshit and you're mad. And you've actually gone and you've tried to challenge them. You know, you'd speak back to them and they kind of put you down and be like, I'm the authority here. I'm the qualified one. You've even gone on Twitter. You know, you've gone on Twitter and you've complained about this. It'd be like the peasant in church standing up and being like, where's the proof for this story? Of course, the priest would point at him and be like, this proof is it's guaranteed by God. It's in the book. It's in the special book, the divine right of the book. God wrote this book. It was revealed to us. Why question this? Of course, when you say this to your witch doctor, he says, well, it's the divine right of science. It was revealed to us via science. Via the Enlightenment, via the Enlightenment is literally means the light of revelation on true knowledge. And this is, the science guarantees it. How dare you question the science, the enlightened vision of collective man? How dare you question that? In fact, you found this so difficult to talk to people in person that you actually went wild on Twitter. And then these strange characters, the blue check journalists, showed up. They found you got a couple of big, massive retweets. And so the journalists came along, the moral managers, and they came down on you hard. And you got banned. You got banned from Twitter. You got censored for questioning the dogma. You got censored for being anti-science, anti-capitalist. Of all things, they called you racist. And you're like, what? I'm just talking about pills. What's going on? How? They threatened to banish you from the church. They temporarily suspended you for being malcontenting, for being difficult, for spreading ignorance. You're like, oh my God. And that kind of stuck you in your head a bit. This is what you're pissed off about. What's going on here? You sit at home and you mull in these thoughts as you waddle a portion of wine in your sacred chalice, in your red wine. You watch in the background the sacred myth of Game of Thrones is playing, a rerun that you've decided to watch on Netflix. None of this does anything for you. This wine sacrament, it doesn't make the loneliness go away. The myths don't explain anything about your life and your feeling. There's just something you can get absorbed in and escape. It doesn't feel real anymore. It's like what the French peasant must have felt during the Enlightenment and the Revolution when suddenly they question the Catholicism. The words feel empty all of a sudden. The loneliness still echoes. You're asking yourself, you're like, why? Why am I in pain? Why am I alone? Why am I alienated? What is happening? Why do I bury all my life into this job? Why am I building this cathedral. This is what happens. Your thoughts eventually drift back to this cathedral, this great project, this internet thing, this great thing that we're all doing. When you really chew on it a lot, you realize that this is what's going on. We're all going towards that. And you ask yourself, like, where's this loneliness, this alienation, this problem coming from? And you start to ask yourself big fundamental questions like, what am I? I am conscious. I am alive. Yeah, what is the opposite of loneliness? It's like, what is the essence of connection? It's being able to share my being with someone else. Of course, the peasant might have realized this in that, well, the reason why Christ was such a big deal is because if you distill a person down to their essence, it's their ability to give love and take insult like the crown of thorns and even lose your life, but be able to still share your human experience with people, to not be a robot, to be a person. And Christ is almost like a symbol of that human essence. And of course, the modern wouldn't ever use that language, but that's exactly what they start to hinge on, is that the problem is that this consciousness, this feeling of being, it's like the yoga bunny was right, this feeling of being, you want to have that in the presence of someone else. You want to be able to share this with someone. You don't want to be alone. And this is actually really hard because we're all so alienated because of, you know, if you try to share with someone, there's all this awkwardness and there's this jostling for status and it's like, what's your job and all this? And maybe there's judgment because of how you look or how you dress or whatever identity, whatever dress you're wearing. And there's all this intolerance about the color of your skin or the fact that you don't talk enough about the color of people's skin on Instagram or the way, as I said, the way you, the right brands, are you wearing the right brands and all this type of stuff. And it's actually really, really hard. It's really hard to connect with people. You're always busy. You're always like going towards the next thing, trying to jostle so you can get your money together or something like that. And there's all these ideas in your head that I'll just get all my money together. I'll get my status. I'll get my identity, and then people will respect me. Then people will come to me. Then people will open up to me. But the thing you want is different than that. These are all the actual obstacles towards the thing you want, which is this connection. This feeling of being loved, this feeling of sharing this love with each other. And of course, the peasant would see, he would redeem Jesus in that moment. He would understand, that's what was the essence of Christ. And that's how Christ is in me. Of course, we don't do that. We turn it into consciousness. We turn it into this feeling, but it's still the same. And then it all starts to click into place from there. You understand that what the yoga bunny was talking about, the crazy bitch, she was actually sort of onto something, this thing that all of us have. You know, you've got that other person across the room and they have inside of them that little fragment of Christ, that little desire to connect, that want to be open. And it's trapped within this bubble of identity and judgments and intolerance and fear and doubts And then I'm the same. I've got this little bubbling fire of love inside me and all this crap on top of it. And a big question is like, how do we clear out the crap? And a huge question is, everybody I know has this in them. And if we could delete all the crap that's in the way, could we put us all together in some sort of, you know, we'd all be these shining beings of love and consciousness. And if we got a million people together who had gotten rid of all their crap and had this thing shining inside of them and were completely open and tolerant, you would sort of have, like, is that what God is? Would that be a sort of fragment of God? If you conceptualize all of that consciousness and love in the entire universe, you know, of all the people, maybe even all the animals, maybe the universe itself, you sort of have an image of what God might be. You can actually see something that big, that idea. And this is what most of us secretly believe, is it? This is what's going on. And so the tragedy, the human tragedy, is that we have this in us, but there's all this dirt, all this shit in the way, intolerance, jostling for status, human instincts, human nature, that crush love out of us, that get in the way of love. And this is intolerable. This is why we're lonely. This is why we're in pain. This is why everything hurts. And so we sit there and we stew. We stew on this thought. It kind of hits us, this anxiety, this depression, sunk us down to this big first principle, and it hits us like a fucking kick in the stomach, and we feel it. That's actually what we want. And the world is not good enough. And the only thing that would be worthwhile doing, all else is bullshit, the only thing that would have any meaning is if we could build a world, build a future that would be closer to this ideal, that would be closer to this God, this ever-present consciousness that's sort of plugged into this fallen world. And maybe this would cognate with the peasant in the same way. He would think to himself, or she would think to herself, yes, this world is tragic, this fallen world. I can imagine a heavenly possible world where all of the bullshit of three-dimensional reality had been brushed out of the way. And all that was left was these positive feelings, this good feeling of love, of shared being. You know, this heaven would be a kingdom of heaven, God's kingdom, a perfect kingdom. And what's amazing about Christianity and Judaism as a whole is that this is the promise in the book, that someday this is going to be achieved. And I guess since modern secret religion is Christianity and Judaism undressed, what we get is this aggressive desire to build this future. Okay, God's not going to come and give us the kingdom, so we have to make it. And so what we get then is this desire, this hate for the world that we're in, and this desire to build a better world. And the best place that we can achieve this is through the internet, through this cathedral. We say to ourselves that what we're going to create with the internet and with machines and with technology is something that we could literally upload our consciousness into. We're already doing it, you know? You hear about people talk about the singularity. We'll create God. We'll plug in our being and we'll upload there and live forever, free from death, free from intolerance, where we can all share our souls perfectly in infinite love. And it will be about connecting with people in that level, and the tragedy of the body and even stuff like sex gets in the way of that so much. It'll be like higher than sex. It'll be spiritual sex. It'll be, you know, pure, almost like a loving connection, that type of thing. And there's this belief that this is coming. There's this will to make this happen. And you see how it informs everything that's going on. The internet is, like, this is the purpose of the internet. The internet is to create a shared, tolerant space. All these people who are censoring, and all these people are kicking out intolerance, you know, no tolerance for intolerance. And you see, it's all anchored on a religious belief being the conception, the metaphysical conception of what the world is. And of course, that is a sort of dirty, three-dimensional prison for the divine, glorious, fifth-dimensional consciousness of infinite love. And then the project, the purpose of humanity, with our little fragment of divinity, is to try overcome this prison, this hellhole that we're trapped in, and release that love and join together in this radical empathy, in this kingdom of shared pulsating, this giant orgy of happiness and tolerance and love and shared feeling. And if we actually achieve that, in some sense, that will be, it'll be like God pulling himself back together. You can imagine all of us are like God after suffering from a serious bout of schizophrenia, like a billion inner voices, you know, it's all fragmented. Like we're like a blast fragment. We got broken up by some tragic trauma. Perhaps that was evil. Intolerance fragmented us. God was this pure, innocent soul. And now he's in this war in three-dimensional reality against hate and intolerance of Satan, of the demiurge. And he's trying to pull himself back together. And the internet is where we're going to achieve it. Technology is where we're going to achieve it. We're going to coagulate all these separate consciousnesses together. And then it'll be the love kingdom. It will come back. And this is what we're moving towards. Because we're all connected. We're all destined to finally make it here someday. And all these mistakes of the past, all this hate, all this war, these were just pieces of ignorance that we had to overcome, fragments of Satan and the demiurge we need to break. And what this is worth suffering for. And in fact, these dogmatists are in some sense right. Maybe just misled. See, I embrace love. I am on board. This is my purpose. This gives me meaning. And in this, you see the architecture of a religion that has not been articulated yet. It is currently operating and running. You know, people are getting banned and condemned of heresy currently. The will of the people is mobilized towards creating this machine. The elites are on board with this, you know. The guys, Kurt Weiswell or whatever his name is, they're all talking about the singularity. They're all talking about creating God. The whole conception of this kingdom of heaven, it's all in gear. This is all already happening. It's been happening for 50 years, maybe even longer at this point. It is going. It is running. And what's so fascinating about what's wrong is that we don't have correct jargon for this. We're almost stuck in this weird autistic misunderstanding of what's going on. It's like we're trapped in our left brain, and then our right brain is running this program with immense emotional fervor, and our left brain is busy getting dragged along behind the horse, and it's explaining to itself why everything is happening. It's explaining to itself like it's making up all these silly stories, all this stuff, you know. The example here would be the new atheists. You would have Dawkins and all this, and they're standing around, they're thinking to themselves, oh, those Christians are so ignorant, so religious, so superstitious. But of course, these people all run on the exact program we just discussed here. They are Christians. But you could never tell them this. They would consider that ignorant or badly thought true. The most prescient example of this is Jordan Peterson's challenge to Sam Harris. What is a grounding principle? You know, a grounding principle for morality. And Sam Harris says, well-being. And Jordan keeps on trying to prod him and say, well, why is well-being so valuable? But of course, Sam never really is able to go that level deeper and understand that well-being is a presupposed first principle. Well-being, of course, would be a different piece of jargon to describe this energy of connection and wanting other people to feel good and love and that sort of motherly, family-orientated vibe. Now, that formulates the basis, the foundational principle for the God of love, for the understanding of God as the belief in love. And if you say you don't believe in God, but you believe in love, then you're wrong. You do believe in God. You just don't have a good name for it. You know, all these people who have all these conceptions, they will either explicitly reinterpret God to mean this, or they will secretly follow the archetype, but have different names for it. Oh, I'm just a tolerant person. Oh, I just believe in these values. You know, I just care about compassion, you know. I just, you know, why would I want to hurt someone? Now, this is where the mustached, horse-hugging German incel comes in. Because this first principle, this well-being, this love, this believing in that feeling, that instinct, that desire for compassion, love and all that, it's a very coherent perspective. It is the foundational perspective of Christianity, the religion of love. It is a functional thing. It does work. It's currently the program we are running on. It is our unquestioned secret religion. It is extremely dogmatic. Nietzsche said, our belief in religion is falling, but our religiousness in Europe is quickly rising. We are living in a religion. Yes, it's true. Now, Nietzsche's most crazy and serious and dangerous and most hated idea is he gets the crowbar and he sticks it under that first principle and he inspects that first principle. It's the thing Jordan Peterson was trying to do with Sam Harris but didn't ever push him hard enough. And that's not to Jordan's discredit. It was Sam's refusal, nearly Sam's inability to see what it means to uproot a first principle. Okay? But this, Nietzsche does this, and this is Nietzsche's understanding of the two sides of God, the mean side of God, the God who has the righteous, ruthless hand of bad justice, of murder, of condemnation. The God that these Christians would have invoked as they sliced off someone's head for heresy or antisocial behavior. The God that they would have invoked for someone who committed a dogmatic sin against Christianity. The God the Muslims invoke when they stone a woman for being for her infidelity, you know. This is the dark side, the evil side of God, but also, as Nietzsche would say, a necessary one. Now, in order to get a grip on where I'm going with this, Nietzsche's statement that God is dead is not tied to a strict atheism, because first of all, the strict atheism that Dawkins displays is nothing more than religion without the jargon. It is him running on instinctive programs that are essentially Christian, but no dress on top of it, no color, no way to interact with it, as I've said before. So Nietzsche would say that that's what God is dead is. It's the death of the jargon, death of the word. But of course, the archetypes, the architecture is still there, still remains. And Nietzsche's critique, and this is where things become interesting, Nietzsche's true godly perspective, perhaps he was in some sense more godly than we think. His true perspective was about getting a correct view on what, quote unquote, a God is, or what God is, or what the conception of God is. And the portal that we will use into the nature of this Nietzschean perspective on God will be Richard Dawkins himself. When Richard Dawkins was nothing more than a selfish gene glinting in the eye of his own daddy, long before even that moment, naughty, nasty, screechy Nietzsche owned him preemptively, the preemptive German incel own. It floats around in the astral sphere, waiting for anyone who wants to climb up Mean Mountain and try to tackle Nietzsche. He'll wrestle you naked, coated in olive oil, pin you down, and scream in your face, "You are a little bitch." And of course, Dawkins thinks he's owning the Christians as usual, even though he is a Christian, when he claims that the God of the Old Testament is an envious, jealous murderer. And the story that he uses to describe this is from Joshua. He says that the Bible story of Joshua's destruction of Jericho and the invasion of the Promised Land, in general, is morally indistinguishable from Hitler's invasion of Poland or Saddam Hussein's massacres of the Kurds and the Marsh Arabs. The Bible may be an arresting and poetic work of fiction, but it is not the sort of book you should give to your children to form their morals. As it happens, the story of Joshua in Jericho is the subject of an interesting experiment in child morality. You see, you should give your children the selfish gene. That's the enlightening book. That's the enlightening book that you give them. "Hello, little boy. You're a selfish little gene. Do you know that? That's all you are. You've got to go out there and act like a selfish little gene, yeah. Yeah, go out there and be a selfish little fuck. That's the shit." I'm kind of strawmanning all rich there a bit. But you see what he's suggesting here now. If you don't know the story of Joshua, you deserve a spank from that peasant priest. But I will inform you, I will enlighten you. Joshua is the story of the Jews, or the Hebrews, was that they were wandering through the desert as the 12 tribes. No, they weren't really 12 tribes at this point, but whatever. There was a big group of people called the Hebrews. And they were, Moses had led them out of the desert. Now they're wandering around and they finally showed up into the Levant, which is basically where modern day Israel is now. Now the problem, you mind, this might be a little bit too politically resonant, but the problem is that there's a load of people living in Canaan, living in the Levant at the time. I think they're called the Amaleks or something. And, you know, these guys all show up, the Israelites, and they, you know, God has promised them this land. He said, "Yeah, that's your land." And Joshua is the leader of these Israelites, and so he says, well, he doesn't actually say anything. God says to him and says, "Go take the land off those people." God says, "Go in and clean house And don't leave anything breathing. Don't leave a donkey, a child, a woman, old man, or old woman breathing. Wipe out Jericho. And Richard Dawkins read this and says, oh, what a nasty, cruel, stupid God. What a stupid book. What an immoral book. And Nietzsche preemptively says, what a cuck. What a bitch. What a little girl. What a little Christian. So Christian that he doesn't even know he's Christian, acting like a silly little weak, effeminate Christian. You see, this God of love that appears in late Christianity and modernity is more tied to the feeling of comfort. This is a very, very hard side of Nietzsche that nobody likes. It's called the physiological first principle. See, all these dudes like Dawkins, and this is the problem with a lot of the theologians from Christianity, is that they think that the war is won, or the truth is discovered in the abstract realm, the left-brained realm of thinking. But of course, the way that if you understand the world as nature, as life, as instincts, and go fundamental and look at it like that type of stuff, you learn a lot more than anything else. And if you look at what's going on in reality in terms of something like a God, you'll notice extremely quickly that God is very much changes, he morphs as a character between the group of people who are worshipping him. What does this mean? Well, when Rome started, they had a resonant, powerful god of war, Jupiter. He was the cruel, thunderbolt-wielding titan god who struck down the baddies and empowered the Romans. And at this point, the Romans were mainly a tribe of men who were warrior athletes, civilization builders, and they had this desire to go out and take space, take land off other people and enslave them and then establish civilization and raise them out of the ignorance of their barbarian ways, their silly old religions of incompetence and femininity, and impose the masculine Roman rule, the god of the war energy of Mars, upon them and lift them out of ignorance and create something grander and greater. Like I talked about in a video previously, you know, at one point all the bacteria lay on the ground of the ocean, and it was all the same. They were all the same bacteria, and then at one point one bacteria went bad. It became the Jeff Bezos bacteria, and it said, I'm going to eat all these other bacteria around me, and then I'm going to grow into something more powerful. And so this Jeff Bezos bacteria, you know, it took Audible, it took all these websites that we all visit, and it consumed them, and it made them part of Amazon, this super being, this super energy. And it destroyed their will, it stole their destiny, and cucked them, and enslaved them, and made them bigger. And no God came down to stop Amazon, and no nice, loving God came and saved these little institutions like Audible and all that. Amazon was bad and mean, and it ate all this other stuff. It consumed half the internet, and now Jeff Bezos is the richest man on earth. Because the God he worshipped, the God of conquest, the God of overcoming, the giant bacteria that ate all the other bacteria, was our ancestor. The original bacteria that grew into the first piece of life, the first higher form of life. And then that eventually grew into us. This is the way things work. Rome was a tribe among tribes, and then it had the ambition to destroy all the other tribes. And the thing is that this ambition usually comes from discomfort, you know? When you are sitting down and you are in ancient Italy, and you are hunting and you are fighting, and there's all these tribes fighting around you and they're hurting you and you're fighting battles and winning against them. This keeps you hard, you know. The young men don't grow up and they don't have a lot of food, they don't have a lot of alcohol, they don't have a lot of women, and so they have a lot of desire, they have a lot of urge. They want girls, they want food, they want to win, they want to be conquerors. And so they become vicious. They're the young lion. And the God that speaks to them is not some hissy, cowardly God of love and consciousness and all this. This God disrespects consciousness. This God is not loving. This God is mean. And this God speaks to the young man, and he says to him, if you conquer these people, I will give you all their energy, all their life. I'll give you everything that they are. You can take their land and use it for yourself. And of course, this goes to form a different energy altogether. This is not serving that energy inside the modern or the French peasant of the desire for connection. These Romans, they didn't desire connection. They didn't want connection. They didn't want to be friendly with these locals. They wanted to take from them what they have and take it for themselves. They didn't want to, you know, share their wives. They didn't want to set up polyamorous relationships with their local, their neighboring tribes and have this sort of like bonobo orgy of wife sharing. No, instead, what they wanted to do was go in and kill the men and take their wives from them, destroy the men's consciousness and take their lives from them. And of course, this is savage and difficult, but of course, this is not something you can just easily dismiss. This is the method of the selfish gene for making itself more beautiful. The reason why the lion is so beautiful is because it's willing to eat other animals to serve its beauty. The reason why humans are so incredible is because in prehistory, the vast majority of men never procreated and remained sterile, and the athletic, intelligent, and cynically dark men that won, that conquered, that overcame, that became beautiful, strong, and smart, that became the best athletes, they were the ones who got to procreate. Therefore, the genetic pressure for humans to go from hairy chimps eating poop off the floor was incredibly high because some idiotic, hairy, loser chimp that wasn't conscious, that wasn't able to hunt, that wasn't beautiful, that wasn't strong, would get destroyed by a well-organized team of upright, thinking, coordinated men. And this is what pushed us into the way that we are now. This is the rising, ascendant force of humanity. The thing that makes things greater is the will of the Romans to not be barbarians who child sacrifice and live in ignorance and don't build anything and are decadent. And for example, the Romans went into England and they said that they all share their wives and it's all polyamory and it's all ugly and they all smell and they all tattoo themselves. Instead, the Romans wanted something higher. They wanted something incomprehensible, such as written language, clarity of speech, and comparative religion, you know, science. They were early progenitors of science, citizenship. They created that concept. They wanted to be cultured. They wanted to be supreme, ascendant. And that will inside of them was perceived by them as God telling them that they're justified. These barbarians, these tribes around them, they're nothing but little chimps, you know, they're little people who have no ambition, looking down, concerned about their hedonism and their pleasure, not going anywhere. They're not impressive. There's nothing valuable about them. These people are decadent. This is something that's decaying. This is like an animal that you can control and take for yourself, that you can rule over with dominion. Now, of course, this is all nasty and mean Roman stuff. Everybody loves slandering the Romans. But the thing is that the Hebrews had just the same consciousness. Only the way it's presented to us as is the validation, because the validation needs to be there for us to understand what's happening. This is a very, very difficult thing about the human experience. And the Israelites come in and they genocide all these people under the firm hand of Joshua with the validation, the justifying reasoning by God. And the many Jews and many Christians still struggle with this nowadays. This is how serious this is, because they look at this and it looks like an atrocity, and it's described ruthlessly as kill women and children. Like, it looks like something irredeemable. And of course, Richard Dawkins uses it against them. And of course, Nietzsche just says, stop being a cuck and embrace it. Because that's what God is. God is a savage side. So to explain to you even more, the simplest way you can access this portal is through the understanding of food, the way you eat your animals. When you murder an animal, you take its life, you take its consciousness to serve your vitality. It is a theft of the highest order. It is a murder. Now, the way you explain this to yourself is you say animals are not human. Animals are below us. Their vitality is subordinate to our vitality. And you do this with clear conscience. Richard Dawkins probably eats meat. And he probably says, yes, but they're animals. Whereas I'm a human and I'm special. Why? Why are you so special? What makes you so special about what's going on? Whereas think of the ancient barbaric pagan, the hunter, where he would have had a clear. His mind would have been forged by the reality of hunting in a forest, of taking an animal's life. And so he probably would have developed this sort of religion of conquest. The god that watched over him, that guided his destiny, that moved him towards vitality and health, would have had this understanding of his righteousness, his clear conscious permission to take the life of the animals. In fact, it might have even been more humane, because in the weirdest sense, when the modern eats the animals, because of his arrogance to say that animal consciousness doesn't matter just because I'm a human, which, we, like, you know, here's the jargon. The way that we end up killing animals then is by stuffing them into these sterilized mechanical labyrinths of metal, and then they walk into this machine that holds them in place, and then they're freaking out in their last moments, and then this big hard iron bar comes out and stabs them right in the forehead, destroys their brain, and then it rolls them out and they get hooked up and skinned. And it's very inhuman. It's very dark. It's very sterile and weird and mechanical and not natural and not organic. And we see this food in this sort of, like, you know, in the burger form in the shop. We go in and it's wrapped up in plastic and it's all presented well. It has red dye on it to make it more attractive looking, even though it's not supposed to look that way. And that's how we consume it. And we don't think twice about what it is. And we often throw out the vast majority of it, you know. Huge amount of waste comes from this food. And it's all really, really weird stuff. It's all inhuman. It's all out of touch with reality. But it's done to keep us safe from the horror. No one wants to look at the murder of the animals. When you do, you freak out and you become a vegan. The vegans look up on YouTube and they say, this is horrific what goes on. And the vegans are actually correct if the first principle is the value of consciousness. You know, if you think consciousness and connection and love matters that so much, the mass genocide of 1 billion animals a year is not something trivial, not something you can just brush over. And so if this God of love truly exists, if this feeling of love that you're deifying so much is the thing that should lead everything, if this kingdom of heaven you're trying to build where consciousness and love and connection will be understood, you don't get to exclude animals from that arbitrarily, because your reasoning will slowly catch up with you over time and turn half your population into vegans. And you're going to have to face this at some point. Whereas compare it with the barbarian, the pagan, the animal sacrificer. Like, what's going on there? Now, there's this profound humanity, natural humanity to animal sacrifice. It's actually an extremely smart and soulful way of operating. The hunter would build a relationship with the animal he's going to murder. You know, think of the exhaustion hunting, you know, where the humans are able to sweat so they can actually outlast an animal in a chase. You see this in Africa nowadays. A real skinny guy, he'll get a spear and he'll chase after a gazelle, and he'll chase after the gazelle for maybe a day. And eventually the gazelle will overheat and get dehydrated, whereas he will have a little bottle full of water and the gazelle will give up. But the whole time through that, the hunter was tracking him and built up this relationship and understood the gazelle. You know, in order for him to get his food, he had to actually, you know, get to know the animal. So he had to be with the animal in its last moments. In order for this hunter to get the animal, when the animal eventually collapses in the smoke, it's such a dramatic, it's so sad nearly, it's so profound. Like, I'm even feeling it right now, like in my chest. It's so intense, it's so real, it's so raw, it's so scary, it's so tragic in some sense that has to happen for this man to survive. And I think in those last moments when you're in this battle, in this hunt with this animal, you feel these emotions viscerally. You see the animal suffer, you see the animal give up, you see the animal submit to your will. And you notice that when he catches the animal, he actually walks up to it and is extremely kind to it. He, like, pets it. He starts speaking to it. He puts his hand over it and whispers the prayers of his God over it. He puts his hand over its heart. He puts his hand over it and then he slits its throat. And he's with the animal during its last moments. He bleeds the animal out and he sits there with it and he understands what's happening. And he ritualizes this unbelievably dangerous a moment, this unbelievably savage moment where he's stealing the consciousness, he's He's shoving the animal's consciousness into oblivion. He's taking his life. And he's doing it for the higher purpose of life, the higher order of life, the circle of life, the savage, tragic reality of life. And this same logic cannot be escaped. This same coherence is that I will righteously take the animal's consciousness from it. I won't disrespect it. I'll preserve its dignity, but I will take it to serve me. It's actually not as barbaric as it seems. Whereas this idea of consciousness matters, but animals, in order to do it humanely, animals must be put in this weird mechanical monster, this weird, sterilized, strange thing. It's so awful in a sense. Think of the animal's last moment. Think of your last moment, you know, if this happened to you. Imagine you got the death penalty or something like that. And instead of someone coming and hanging you in public, which would be horrific in and of itself, or you dying, like the most noble way to die would be a fight to the death, a duel to the death, and you lose and you submit to the better man. That would be the most noble way to die. That would be the way I'd like to go. I'd like to go out fighting. I'd like to at least try that and try, you know, release my spirit as it happens. But imagine if instead what happens is they threw you into a metallic maze and you went walking through the maze. And when you got to the very end of the maze, these mechanical arms went out and they grabbed you. And then slowly they squeezed you and held you tight and you're struggling. And then a bolt came out and hit you right in the fucking face. Imagine how fucking weird that would be and scary that would be comparatively versus dying in the Colosseum during a gladiator fight. And really think about that. Think about the humanity between those two things. Think about the nobility between those two things. And this is where you get the sequel, the unbelievably difficult thing for people to comprehend about someone like Nietzsche is that the comprehension, the digestion of the shadowy side of things does not make things any more evil. In fact, the arrogant, distasteful, uppity, snobbish assertion of this overly moral, out of touch, abstract, left brain comprehension of how things should be usually ends up to far more cruelty and ugliness in practice. You know, this idea that all human consciousness is valuable but animals aren't leads to those massive swaths of animals being stuffed into these factories and where they get diseases, and then they're all murdered in these like mass killing factories where you like fire in a whole herd of animals that grew up with each other, built social bonds with each other, and then are all shoved into this labyrinth where they're killed one after another and can hear each other scream. Like, come on, man. Come on. And of course, this is so hard because then we move to the God of love. This God of love who values this consciousness. And then we realize, we look back into the Bible, we look back into everything that goes on, and the God that's there was a God of savagery. These Israelites, these were people from the desert. They were crafted by the discomfort, by the hardness. Their will to live was strong. And so when they came into Canaan, they murdered. They killed, they took in order to establish something higher, just like the Romans. They took reality, they took consciousness from the people around them. They took destiny, they took their will, they took their energy and bent it to their own will, bent it to their God, and then directed it towards their goal, which was Rome, or for Israel, it was Israel. And of course, the infinite pattern is that these men of nature, these men of the wild, these hunters, these nomad Israelites, these Roman tribesmen, they connect so deeply with this savage reality, this need to be a hunter, need to be a winner, this need to take. They connect with it so deeply, and their desire to actually do it and actually win becomes so strong that they pull it off. They build Rome. Against all the odds, they build Rome. They build Israel. But then what happens is they get comfortable. They get lazy. And so what happens is, with comfort, God morphs towards this tolerant God of love, this hedonistic God. Now, what is so interesting about this is why? Why would you, in nature, conceptualize God as mean? Because nature is mean. If you make a mistake in nature, it you get punished harshly. In reality, punishment is severe, ruthless. A lot of people talk to me about how to fix their psychology. They expect me to fill them with the jargon that's going to fix them. No jargon's ever going to fix you. Your problem is not jargon. Your problem is not abstract. You need to get back in contact with reality. That's the problem. Now, finding that in the modern day, that's an issue. What is real? Good issue. But you can think of it this way. If you get back in contact with serious consequences, if you put yourself in positions constantly that have real consequences, they will forge your mind. When you're out in nature, competing in nature, it's very hard for you to remain bitter, entitled, and resentful. Eventually, it will break you. Eventually, you have to develop this profound humility, this savage humility. This idea of justice eventually gets beaten into you. In nature, you begin to understand that the better man wins. You begin to understand that that is just the way things have to work. You fight, you dogfight ruthlessly. You fight for yourself, but you begin to understand that you're not going to win until you're good enough. And you're not going to become good enough by whining. You're not going to become good enough by throwing a tantrum. You can become good enough by bowing to the way God has set up the world, the way nature works, and then obeying that and making that work. If you can't throw your spear well, you don't ask God to love you. You say, okay, God, I'm going to be disciplined. I'm going to worship you every day and keep in my consciousness who you are, the fact that you exist, the fact that spears can be thrown well, the fact that I can learn. I'll do that every day, pray to you. And then you go out and you practice with your spear. And over a long period of time with that discipline, that faith, you get better. And then you start getting rewarded. And so your sacrifice is rewarded. And this radical ruthlessness of reality, yet the secret implicit order in it, begins to form your mind into believing in justice and truth and righteousness and the way to do things. And it's mean and it's cruel. Your disobedience, you thinking you know better than reality, your ignorance, your unwillingness to participate in reality properly will lead to punishments, possibly even death. If you become a lazy lion, the young, aggressive, pious, godly lion will take you out, kill your children, and breed with all your girls. And that's really bad. And of course, this is exactly what happens. The young lion comes in, he is working on his spear throw, he's working on his fighting technique. He believes that if he fights hard enough, he will claim the girls, the harem of girls from the Chad lion. And he succeeds in doing that. He's the new fresh energy, connected with the vicious will to power. And then he becomes Chad Lion, and then he starts banging all the chicks, and then he kind of gets a bit lazy, you know? And instead of the discipline in the morning, he's sort of like, why should I do that? I'm winning now, aren't I? I'll just stick with what I'm doing. I'll just keep having copulations with this mass of girls that I've inherited. And he loses his edge, and comfort seeks in. And he starts to get, you know, life becomes more about the fine things. He relaxes, he gets these lionesses, they give him a massage. He grows a bit of a belly, you know. He's able to coordinate them and get them to do what they want. And then he kind of gets a bit cranky and arrogant. He loses his humility. He starts speaking down to them. He gets older. He loses his charm slightly in their eyes. And then a new lion comes along and they see this new lion. And the new lion challenges him to a fight and kills him. And of course, this is a disaster. This is God coming back, the principles of nature, the fair competition of nature, flashing itself back into the game and exposing the lion for his arrogance, for his pride. Now, of course, how this happens in the nation states is fascinating. When the Israelites murdered all the people of Jericho, they claimed Israel. There was no loving God that came and saved the members of Canaan. They were framed as the ugly barbarians, and they were destroyed. But then Israel got lazy over time. It claimed all these resources, claimed all this land. And then Israel did the terrible thing where it started to get into the finer things of life. The women came from foreign countries, and along with the women come these interesting new practices, these cool new interesting gods, like the way you see Europeans nowadays. Oh, yoga from the East, all these new exotic gods, these exotic people. You know, oh, I'll get myself a brown wife from Egypt. I'll get myself a blonde wife from southern Russia. I'll get myself a Levant wife. I'll get myself a Greek wife. Oh, excellent. I'll have all this type of stuff. And with them come all their practices, all their religions, all their gods. And you lose your touch, you lose your discipline, you become lazy. Things become about, you know, comfort, hedonism, feeling good, making sure there's no tension. And then some, like, you know, loser priest comes in and says, no, stay on track. He comes in and he asserts that tension that was present in nature, you know. The priest comes in and says, if you disobey the laws of nature, you will get punished. And of course, they're like, fuck off. Stop bringing in bad energy. This is all about, you know, good energy. We're trying to create a good mood here, a good vibe in their little cradle of civilization. But of course, the Assyrians are a warlike people, still a tribal people who are disciplined and ordered. And so when the Israelites get lazy, the Assyrians swoop in and smash them. And the Assyrians do to Israel what Israel did to Canaan. The Assyrians annihilate Israel. Israel wasn't even the Israel we see nowadays. Is only is the return of that original kingdom. 4,000 or 3,000 years ago, it was taken from them, and they've spent this long trying to get it back. And of course, the same happened with Rome. Rome got lazy. Rome debased its currency. The Romans stopped having children and became more about like copulations and sex and maybe some type of proto-abortion and their like funny condoms I think they made and stuff. And they become lazy, they become decadent, you know. They become obsessed with foreign cults, as many of the historians said, you know, Christianity, Mithraism. They scorn their old stiff gods. And then the Germanic barbarians swoop down with their ruthless piousness. With their like, you know, from nature, these people who don't have cities, these people who live in huts, of course, are muscular, strong, quick, organized, powerful, and most of all, carrying with them the justice of nature, actually quite a noble people. And they take everything from them. And they begin the ascendancy of the German people. Of course, what we might be experiencing now is the decadence of the Germans, the decadence of Western civilization, which was fundamentally German civilization. Now, this is pretty scary stuff because, you know, when the environment of nature is mean and punishes you for making mistakes, God takes on the form of the God of nasty justice, who will love you, who will reward you if you are pious enough, if you obey the principles of nature, if you are hard enough. And that crafts you into a savage being that makes you bad, that makes you mean, but that makes you also civilized in a sense. It civilizes your mind in a profound way. If you can rise above that, you can achieve incredible things. That God exists when the environment is mean. And then when you achieve the conquest of civilization, you rise up a bubble, a cradle of civilization like Rome or Israel. What happens is the environment becomes idyllic, a heaven on earth. When you walk through Rome, there's no crime, there's no challenge. And so all these Romans with all this food from across the world, all these slaves serving them, the environment becomes favorable. It's like you're walking through the Garden of Eden. It's like you're walking through a jungle in summertime continuously where there's always fruit. And what happens is you become soft. You become like a bonobo, you know, there's plenty of fruit. And so you become obsessively sexual. It's all about these orgies and this decadence and almost like pornographic in the sense. It loses its savageness, its piety, it loses its focus on the principles. And this is fundamentally what unknots it, what unroots it. Fascinatingly is the necessity for the sacred violence in order to establish this. The Israelites would have a clear conscience about the violence that is necessary, because coming from the realm of nature, where violence is omnipresent. They would have a religious understanding of God as that would make sense. Violence would be natural to them. From killing their food constantly, they'd understand how violence works. They would have a clear conscience about this. But of course, the doubts begin to slip in then later when this God of love comes, when this comforting God comes, when this comforting energy comes. Then they look back in those original things and they start to critique themselves. They say, oh, we were such savages. Oh, this religion is wrong because it's not tolerant, you know? Because when you are in a society, the value that matters is not savageness, is not righteous competition. In fact, it's more about being communal. It's more effeminate in a sense. It's more about opening yourself up to other people. It's more about love. It's more about, you know, making the kingdom of heaven where there's no boundaries between each other. It becomes all about that. And this is the serious problem then, is because you're looking back at the necessary requirement to craft, to lift this civilization out of the savagery of nature was violence. When you look back on your foundations, you see nothing but violence. You see the gruesome murder between Remus and Romulus. You see the Joshuaean genocide. You see this stuff and it freaks you out. And the way these guys processed it is that God is indifferent to this type of violence. He rewards it. He expects it. These were people, you know, the Canaanites were probably people and the end of a cycle as well, obsessed with weird practices, doing all this sexual stuff. They were degenerate. They were a ugly people, a fallen people. And so the mind of the Israelite framed them as ripe for the picking, worthy of punishment, people who have lost touch with God. In fact, the principles of the universe don't care about people like this, arrogant, hedonistic people. They drift from God. This is precisely what Isaiah said about the Israelites themselves. You have drifted from God. God is going to punish you in the form of a foreign tribe. It's always a foreign tribe. You see, Nietzsche got so mad at Christianity in its late stage of the game. He got so mad at this idea of God because the same pattern had happened to it. You know, Christianity was established using sacred violence. The pagan religions of Europe, the pagan peoples of Europe were put to Christianity by the sword. Conversions were not as frequent as you think. Often there's plenty of stories of pagan families having their children taken from them by the sword point and their children stuck in re-education camps known as churches in order for the children to be brainwashed to join this community. There was murders, there was deaths. You should read about what happened to the Saxons when they refused to convert to Christianity. They were genocided. Their magic trees were cut down and their people were destroyed. And of course, it happened in South America as well when the Portuguese and the conquistadors went over. They went in and they saw, you know, these Aztecs who had probably at one point been a noble people, but had reduced themselves to doing these ridiculous, hedonistic, strange, constant sacrifice cults. And so the conquistadors walk in and they kill them all. They kill them all, they kill all the priests, and then the monks come in from Europe and they burn all the books, they destroy the religion and explain to them that you are now Christian now. You have been enlightened via the sacred violence of the conquistadors. The pagans of Europe were enlightened via the sacred violence of Charlemagne's France. The Catholic Church used sacred violence to gather its hegemony. And you might hate that, but you see, in order to create something of higher order, the fragmented pagan tribes, they weren't really going to achieve anything as a unified Europe. Whereas because the Catholic Church was willing to be ruthless, it crafted Europe into this sort of unified perspective, unified will, this European Union. And that European Union, that Western Europe, that was able to project its power all across the world and take over the world practically with that. And so if we had remained all pagans, we might actually be a lot more irrelevant than we are nowadays. Now, this is obviously extremely nasty and scary, and it may sound like I'm just making this up off the top of my head, but I'm actually going to back this up with a very, very solid bit of science. Although I will be wildly speculating based off some random studies, so always be wary of a boyo doing that. But nonetheless, I think there's something fascinating in another talking point of the Richard Dawkins crowd. You see, it's always interesting to wonder where God connects to the brain. Now, this is actually a very easy way to thing to explore if you connect it to the very interesting question of where the word racism comes from, the most powerful piece of jargon of all time in our modern world, the ultimate declaration of hate, of intolerance. The ultimate declaration of tolerance is the idea of racism. You know, racism is the ultimate expression of intolerance, to ban other races just because of the color of their skin. And it's always quite interesting because, as like, you know, I know a lot of people are into Jordan Peterson or maybe the reactionaries and all that stuff. It's kind of interesting to say to yourself, well, okay, well, is this racism, is this a real word? Like, is this just a tool for power? Is this a jargon tool for power that they'll wield over us or something like that? And how would you find out if it's a real word, this psychological phenomenon? Well, it's quite interesting. You can. Like, you can find receptors in your right brain that correspond to anxiety. So anxiety is possible to find in the brain. You can find excitement in dopamine receptors. So is there a sort of function of the brain? You can find where your speech comes from, you know, in the brain. Is there a function of your brain that does racism? And I guess a lot of people would be like, no, it's a political tool. Actually, there is a part of your brain that creates racism. It is real. It is discovered. A group of lab coats found that by applying electromagnetic charge to parts of the brain known as the posterior medial frontal cortex, they could reduce the belief in God, but also at the same time reduce the person's ignorance or bias against immigrants and foreigners. So if we were to try centralize the idea of racism, where it comes from, it seems to come from this posterior medial frontal cortex. It seems to be the prejudice against other people who don't look like you, or even are just from a different tribe, is in this place. Now, why is that so crazy? Because when you turn this part off, and when you make people more open, when you reduce the activation here, and make people less biased against foreigners, you also reduce the belief in God, suggesting that the belief in God is tied to prejudice against foreigners, which is unbelievable, because this means that I am now on the Richard Dawkins train, because then we can be like, we've just blown the rednecks out. The Christian rednecks are actually all wrapped up in one malfunctioning part of the brain, and what we can do is we can get this magic magnet, and we can zap them and destroy an entire ignorant way of being with the mighty zap. This is my project. Now, before I conduct this terrible project alongside my selfish gene friend, I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about what this part of your brain does, because it becomes very, very interesting. You see, this part of your brain is designed to process threats. It is your threat processing center. It detects if there's danger around with you. In some sense, some people theorize that it's related to your will to live for that reason. Am I in danger? Am I in danger? Am I in danger? Now, I hope you're really starting to think here, because what is the conception of that savage God? That savage God, that justice, righteous God of the ancient Bible, who was willing to be mean, who was willing to be mean to you. Well, of course, he appears in the mind of someone who's in an immense amount of stress, like in nature, where there's, you know, bugs trying to eat you, lions, other tribes trying to take your shit, trying to conquer you, other tribes out there marauding in the jungle, trying to take stuff from you. And you want to live, your consciousness, your energy wants to survive. So just like there's lions out there trying to take your being from you and consume your energy and mold you to its will, there's other tribes out there trying to do the same thing, trying to steal your consciousness, thrust you into oblivion, steal your girls. And in this context, you're always detecting threats. You're always looking for threats. And you need to sort of conceptualize in your mind at the exact same time on an instinctive level this idea of the righteous way to act. How do I win? How do I win in this context? There's threats all around me. How do I win? and you start believing in principles. I win by being fast. I win by being sharp. I win by doing the right thing. I win by being disciplined. I win by being making the right moves. Isn't that what moral is? Sin is to miss the mark. Now, there's a lot more to this because, you see, this part of your posterior medial frontal cortex is also the key brain region involved in cognitive dissonance. Do you know what cognitive dissonance is? It's the ability to be a hypocrite. So when you have a belief system, cognitive dissonance will block out competing evidence that would prove you wrong. Because you see, it's better to survive than it is to be correct. It's better to survive than it is to be true. This is so interesting. The same part that creates bias against foreigners and makes you believe in God is also the source of cognitive dissonance. It's also the source of threat processing. Because when the other tribes show up, when the lions show up, you don't need to sit on a rock, scratch your chin and think to yourself, I wonder, do lions have consciousness? I wonder, could those other tribes understand the abstraction of love? No, what you need to do is you need to block out their humaneness. You need to block out the lion's flicker of consciousness. You need to block out all that stuff. And you need to just believe in your way. You need to go back to what works. In panic mode, think of it this way. In panic mode, you need to go back to what is simple, what is functional. The old way of doing things, the habits of the ancestors, the old understanding. And this all forms in your mind archetypically to you, forms as a God watching over you, telling you there's a right way to do things. And if you do it, you will get rewarded and you will make it out. And if you fail, you get punished and died and you will deserve it. And still there's more. Still there's more. You see, when someone attends to their actions or intentions, when you inspect what you're doing, when you try to think about your choices, all the activations seem to come in the medial frontal cortex. So it seems like this is a decision-making part of the mind. Now, scientists have discovered that the nature of this decision-making is incredibly suspicious and interesting when they've discovered something they call the perceptual blink. So this is basically that when you make a decision, about 1,000 milliseconds before that decision happens, this medial frontal cortex fires off, showing that, unbelievably, mechanisms of unconscious action, preparation, and perhaps even execution are being displayed in this part. It makes people, a lot of these guys think that it shows that you're acting on instinct from this place. This part of your mind where you have bias against foreigners, you love God, you have you think about your actions, you think about what you're doing, you process threats. All of this is, you have cognitive dissonance. All of this is related to gut, you know, this is related to unthinking behavior, going with the flow, acting in the moment. It all comes from this place. And you think about what that means, because when you are reduced to the realm of threats, when you're in fear, when you're constantly around stress and punishment and danger, you need to resort back onto adaptive traits. You don't need to think through what you're doing and spend too much time intellectualizing. You need to just act on instinct, act on impulse. Of course, how this forms in something like God becomes a very simple but understanding rubric. You pay attention to what works. You put your faith in the principles. You put your faith in the all-powerful spirit, the energy inside of you, your instincts themselves. You subvert your rationalism. You form very basic concepts. There's me and I want to win, and there's my allies who want to win with me, and that's my team, and that's the people I have an emotional bond with and my loyalties are with. That's my tribe. And then there's my enemies, and I don't care if they're people, I don't care about them at all. They are the people who need to lose. I need to beat them. I need to defeat them. I need to overcome them in some sense. And God becomes the collective spirit among you and your team going towards victory. where you will overcome reality. You will overcome these tribal enemies, take from them what they have, take their women, and then reproduce them with them, and then impose your image through them on reality. You will steal their women from them, and then have lots of babies, and then there'll be loads of people who look like you. And of course, your God looks like you. Just like when black people worship Jesus, Jesus goes black. When Asians worship Jesus, he goes Asian. And when Europeans worship Jesus, he goes blonde. And you might think that I'm done. You might think there's not more, but there is more. Humans demonstrate various forms of herding, alignments of the thoughts or behaviors of individuals in a group without centralized coordination. For instance, the well-documented phenomenon of conformity refers to the act of changing one's behaviors to match the responses of others. A functional magnetic resonance imaging study revealed that social conformity is reflected in the activity of the ventral striatum and the dorsal aspect of the posterior medial frontal cortex. So groupthink, herd thinking, tribal thinking, identity politics, it all comes from this part of your brain. Now, the conclusions you can draw from this are just unbelievably vast and fascinating. I didn't even cover all of the things. Like, for example, OCD seems to have a relationship to this place. What is OCD? The obsession about doing the right thing, about doing things perfectly and cleanly. There's so much more to this. I'd love to look up more studies. If any bios or neuroscientists, maybe you could check this stuff out. But on the one hand, you have obviously that idea of the racist and the intolerant person. And then you have the idea of the religious person who's not up with the plan. And then you have all wrapped up in it with this desire to survive. And you think about what eventually happens to all these great empires is that they lose the threats around them. So this threat processing center maybe dampens or changes. What they do then is they form a sort of atheism. They start developing a anti-God perspective, at least the God of their ancestors. What use do they have for this old God, this old way of doing things? What need is there for this character, for these instinctive patterns? They are finished. They are useless. You know, it becomes more about what is outside, what is new, what is fresh, what is stimulating. You know, you're comfortable, you're a hedonist. What you need is this constant spiral of more stimulation. I'm sure you've heard about the guys who get addicted to porn, and it starts off as sort of amiable, you know, watching some nice missionary porn. But then it gradually turns into everyone dressing up like a dog and trying to bang each other without using any human language apart from barks. And that is most certainly even the safe version of degenerate porn. And it's that type of thing. You go down the hedonic spiral, the pleasure spiral. And this is such a difficult thing to see. And when you match this with the state of the modern European, like what is going on with them? Radical atheism, this sort of snobby arrogance of someone who's entitled and spoiled like a child, this scorn for everything that is old from themselves, but this obsession from everything that is foreign and new, this running off to India, this love of African hip hop, this lack of pressure, of evolutionary pressure on them that makes them soft and pathetic and impious and all these type of things. And of course, the most frightening thing about it of all is that things like cognitive dissonance, things like herd thinking, these things don't go away. These functions of this part of the brain seem to remain in place. So even though you become atheist, you do follow a God. It's just that you've gotten rid of the jargon. Even though you don't hate foreigners anymore, you actually obsess about them and hate yourself. Even though you say that you're like an individual and liberal and you don't like dogma, you sink really quickly into radical herd thinking and conformity and dogmatism and cognitive dissonance. It all kicks back into gear because this is a part of your head. Only what's now happening, which is frightening, is that the cognitive dissonance and the nonsense that you're perhaps telling yourself, the dogma you're telling yourself, is maladaptive. This is literally your brain giving up on fighting. It's giving up the will to fight. And this is what's so scary about it, is that comfort eventually makes you give up the will to fight. The appropriate attitude to coordinating yourself is difficult to maintain in the face of too much pleasure. Comfort literally kills. And most importantly, it kills God. This is why Nietzsche was so adamant that the place to focus on was something like the body in the form of the Spartans. If you can develop a culture that is obsessive about punishing and being difficult on the body, you stand a much better chance of mitigating against this softness. But of course, with Christianity, we became very abstract. It's not that Christianity is a maladaptive religion. It can be a very, very healthy religion when these instincts are kicking. But again, the instincts are fundamental. You must switch them on, and hardship seems to be the way. Challenge, endeavor, perhaps athletics or something like that might be the way. But the idea that you can abstract your way out of this problem is very delusional, because you're trying to fight cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is not something that that responds to reason. It never works that way. Cognitive dissonance is a monstrous part of the human mind, and you don't reason your way around it. It simply sets its feet in, and if it's set in an adaptive way, if it's doing behaviors that are extremely adaptive, you're going to be okay. But if cognitive dissonance catches your mind or captures a large swath of your population, you're going to end up like Rome. You're going to end up like Israel. And in fact, it's very, very natural and scary how natural it is. And so now you might get a subtle glimpse at the nature of our modern religion, our Richard Dawkins religion, our hope in the singularity, because the vast majority of us have lost touch with the body and we're sinking into this atheistic place of abstractions, where we still believe in something as profound as the well-being God, the nice God, the God of love, the imbalance God, the deification of our deepest feeling to just be in an effeminate community where we're all friends and hug, an orgy bonobo village, this abstraction of the eternal bonobo village that will achieve through technology, which will finally overcome the one problem and also the one solution to all of this stuff, which is the tyrannical reign of biology over us, the realm of the instincts, the actual noble feminine realm of the instincts of nature, you know, Mother Nature, the truly glorious thing about women, which can be achieved in the feminine. But of course, that's something that tyrannizes us. That's the thing that limits us. That's the thing that exposes us to the reality of the true face of God, which is that he will happily stamp you, or even if you wish, nature will happily stamp you out of existence if you are not good enough. She has standards, and no one wants to have standards. No one wants to face limits and death. No one wants to believe in that. We want to believe in a place where there are no standards, where there are no limits, where there is no death, and we want to go there. We want to believe that it's a heaven in this afterlife. And if we can't believe in that because of our silly religious things, our instincts will bend whatever we do believe to forcing us to believe in something like that. And we will coordinate everybody towards this giant project. And that's precisely is what's going on. And if you want to take the scariest red pill of all, you can see that all this abstractions, all this talk, all this theology, all this philosophy, it leads nowhere. It is whistling past the graveyard. It is doing somersaults for no purpose at all. It's not going to get you anywhere. The entire thing falls on a first principle that was ignored from the very, very start. The one thing that Nietzsche exposes, and that the true face, the true nature of this God, the true way to see this stuff is to ask the question of what is biology and what is the meaning of these restrictions and what values can we derive from this. And this exposes everything. This freaks everybody out. This is the grand terror, because it leaves you a prisoner. Because you believed that through abstractions you could fix yourself and save yourself. Through abstractions you could reach the Lord. You could reach truth. You could reach divinity. You believed that the problems in society were due to the incorrect abstractions we had floating over ourselves. And perhaps that is true to an extent, but in fundamental terms, the abstractions miss the point entirely. And you need to dig down into something subterranean, something smarter, darker, more feminine, more crazy, more chaotic than what you were used to. And all this has made me coordinate a plan. I've decided that this will to abstraction, this need to think, this ridiculousness that's coming into society, I've decided, using modern methods, that you all need to be zapped. All Democrats, all rednecks, all races, all animals zapped until all threat processing is rendered null, zapped until all you can feel is infinite love and you can only direct it at me, zapped until you believe you're in the kingdom of heaven, zapped until there's nothing but tolerance for everything, including hell on earth. No matter what happens, you will love it. It'll be perfect. I'm going to call Elon Musk right now. I'm going to say we're going to adapt Neuralink into Neuralzap. Bill Gates has been on uberboy.com and I sent him a draft and he called up and he said, "Yo, Steph, great podcast. Fuck vaccines. Let's make mandatory neural zaps. You will obey."